shaved this morning.
No, sir, you need to shave, Milt.
Oh, and look at those fingernails.
Look at those fingernails. Look, Milt, Mary Ellen is a wonderful manicurist, and I'm a pretty good barber.
You no, I don't need anything.
Just come with us. We'll explain the whole
thing. I don't think you understand. I don't need to.
We're all set. I need it right down here, and we'll take care of you immediately. All right, just relax. I'm the barber.
I'm
Lady. I'm the very best in town.
I'm sure that I'm fine.
I'd like to shave him closer, but his nose gets in the way. Oh.
When?
Yes, Milt.
Did I have a drink?
Sure. Why, you thirsty?
No, I just want to see if my neck still holds water.
And welcome to Random Access Television, the podcast where we review and discuss a random television show picked for us by our giant supercomputer. This time we're brought to you by Tootsie Rolls, who would like to remind you that yes, we still make them, and yes, they know you don't like them. This time around, we'll be talking about the early 50s show, The Paul Winchell and Jerry Mahoney Show, and spoilers, Jerry Mahoney is a ventriloquist dummy.
So Zach, I am not much of one for the puppets. Or Tootsie Rolls, and both of these things kind of freak me out, and they don't taste good. Both the puppets and the Tootsie Rolls. So, this episode does have some really fascinating history, though, that you were excited to talk about. So I was thinking we can dive right into that, and instead of starting out with giving our normally cute and colorful quips, how about you give these people some history?
Sure. So, yeah, oftentimes when I'm doing research on a show like this, it gets a little difficult. Like, the show or the person just doesn't have much going for them or is very interesting. For instance, when we did that reality show from the early 2000s, it was just a reality show from the early 2000s. But this time, I did not have that problem at all. To the point where I'm actually thinking of working on my screenwriting skills to see about making a Paul Winchell biopic.
Oh, my God.
So, Paul Winchell was born Paul Wachinski in New York to a second-generation Jewish immigrant family. At age 13, while he was fighting polio, he sent away for a ventriloquism kit and made a routine by stealing jokes from magazines, eventually getting onto the radio at 1938 at the age of 16, and by 1943 having his own show. He was overshadowed, though, and quickly canceled because the other ventriloquist radio show, Charlie McCarthy and Edgar Bergen, was a much bigger hit. It was a weird era.
The dueling ventriloquist shows, I think that was a point in time.
Dueling radio shows. Remember, ventriloquist, radio, whatever. When TV started, he was an early adopter, and eventually this show was born. So the Paul Winchell and Jerry Mahoney Show is a really odd duck. So it was on from September 18th, 1950 to May 23rd, 1954 on NBC, and during this time it had multiple formats. We watched two different ones for this show. It actually started as a game show titled My Name. Yeah, it was titled What's My Name?
Show.
Yeah, I know. And they were hosting, it had some sketch elements, and eventually the sketches kind of took over the show.
Okay. I can kind of see where the game show element might come in a little bit, though.
Yeah, so we watched the Christmas episode from that particular format. Mm-hmm. Eventually, not too long after the episode we watched, they started having 10-minute long dramatic vignettes starring famous actors and occasionally Winchell, but not Mahoney. Winchell is the human. Eventually, it left primetime and became a standard for the time kids show, but it was also the first kids show on Saturday mornings. It was the first ever TV show on Saturday mornings.
Really?
Or along with the first batch, yeah.
Okay, interesting.
TV shows were only basically at night for the first couple of years until the Today Show hit, and then they started stretching it further and further, and NBC eventually made Saturday morning cartoons a thing, but only after about 5 or 6 years of TV being around.
Wow. So. Okay. Because definitely I think for our listeners out there who maybe haven't watched it, which is probably most of you, it seemed like sort of your stereotypical, like when you think of 1950s kids TV show, this is more or less what you would think of.
Well, yeah, and that's the second episode we watched. The first one, though, was a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And so we can talk about that one here. It was a primetime sketch show in front of a live audience, and you could tell because sometimes you could hear them coughing or laughing too loud. I always kind of liked that aspect of it.
Yeah.
the first episode, the Christmas one, how much did you hate it?
Okay, well, so I was dreading watching this show. I really don't like puppets that much. Ventriloquists freak me out. And I mentioned last episode, I respect the art. I respect the craft. But the whole thing terrifies me. And this, yeah, this Christmas episode, I mean, as a debut show, so this one, this you're saying that the Christmas episode, that was meant for kids or not meant
no.
for kids?
No. It was audience shows. I believe it aired at like 7:30, 8 o'clock at night. So it was okay. Kind of in that family era.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. And that also explains why in the first 5 minutes, a puppet like literally hits on a 5-year-old.
Yeah. He does that a couple of times in other things I've seen, too. He just, every female that pops by, he kind of just, yeah, starts.
Like, I know you guys, are the same size, but puppet, this is wrong. Like, because this puppet is huge. It's huge. Yeah. It's the size of like a 5-year-old. It's an enormous puppet.
It's got more articulated arms than most mm-hmm. other puppets. He actually developed some sort of special system for controlling the arms at the same time as controlling just the head. So it's not like your typical stereotypical one where it's just moving his eyes and head. His right. arms move and actually kind of work a little bit.
Right. There was a couple times when that was demonstrated. And I mean, like I said, I hate this. I hate the puppets. But with that said, I respect the artistry. I think it's really amazing. And this was all live.
And you could tell because sometimes it was great. There was a moment where there was a shadow coming in and I'm like, oh, is this a character about to come in? But no, it was just a shadow of some crew member who walked in front of a Gleek light somewhere.
Right.
So this was a Christmas episode. I've actually seen this not many times before. I've seen this before. I have an annual tradition every November and December. I watch as many Christmas episodes I've never seen as possible, usually between 300 and 500 a year. And this I have definitely seen before. I was kind of excited to see it again because I'll admit I laughed quite a bit watching this.
Oh, wow. Okay, cool.
I love this cornball humor. I was even while I was pulling clips before the show, the what routine where they had the earmuffs on. Mm-hmm, I was mm-hmm. laughing again just listening to that.
It was pretty amazing to see it. To see that live, very vaudeville. It was impressive, I do admit.
Okay. Well, I mean, you don't have to, you know, hold back here. but I do like that. So this was a Ghost of Christmas Past, pastiche, a Scrooge sort of thing. Right. I've probably seen about, I don't know, 60 to 100 of those by now. This was the only one that went out of order that I can recall as it went past, future, present. Yeah, the future one was great because it took place all the way in the year 2000 on the moon.
That was the part I absolutely liked the best. I thought yes. that the they had sort of this other fellow and his moon wife or something. Mm-hmm. Her outfit was really cool. It was a really well done skit. And I mean, the puppet was very secondary in this skit. I think yeah. more, I'm sorry, I do not know the actor's name. But
Paul Winchell, yeah.
No, not Paul Winchell. The Moon Man.
The Moon People, yeah. I didn't get their names either. There aren't a lot of, it's not a lot of information for individual episodes of this show.
Right. And there was this one part where, actually, you could probably play a clip of this if you wanted to. There was the one where he's like, oh, Snoo. You mean yes. Snoo? Yeah, that was yeah. really excellent.
Yeah, let me go ahead and play it. There's a character named Zumba.
Zumba.
That was probably the highlight of the show. I'm going to go ahead and play a clip of Zumba's entrance and a couple of his cheesy jokes.
Who are those two?
Your Highness, they came
Don't turn around. Don't embarrass them. Don't hurt their feelings.
But Your Highness,
see how you keep looking at them? I ask you not to look at them. Don't
but Your Highness,
they You see how you keep looking? Please don't turn around.
Your
don't
Highness. Me.
You know, it's embarrassing.
They ask you many times not to do it. This guy's ready for the butterfly net.
Zumba, Your Highness. Please let us go back to the earth. For there is Christmas and Santa Claus and snow.
Snow?
Yes, sir.
You mean Snoo.
Well, what's Snoo?
Nothing. What's new with you?
That one will kill you.
No, sir. It just makes us sick a little bit.
Yeah, I really liked the Zumba guy, and I thought it was a little interesting because he was... There is a little dash of queer coding there.
Totally.
And,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I thought that was probably, I think, as far as media goes, probably one of the earliest like queer coded TV show characters I had personally seen.
Kind of for the old timers there like me, he had a little bit of a Joe Besser from the Abbott and Costello show, the "I'll harm you" kind of
right,
voice.
Right, right. And I noticed that actor who I think voices Knucklehead Smith.
It's all Paul Wenschel.
It's all, oh my God. Okay, well, yeah, see, whenever I start saying I don't like a show, this is what happens. I start eating my words because I start to really respect that everyone is really freaking talented. And this isn't, you know, as opposed to like some shows that I think we'll maybe have in the past, maybe have in the future. You know, it's not just a cheesy reality show. I mean, there's a lot of talent and acting and
Or just something like our first show that we did, Step by Step, which is just a by-the-numbers sitcom after 40 years of making by-the-numbers sitcoms.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And despite puppets freaking me out, this was amazing. It was amazing. So, yeah.
Knucklehead Smith was not actually in Smith, S-M-I-F-F. He was not actually in that episode. It was all Mahoney. Knucklehead Smith. Sorry if I'm blowing out your speakers. But just a little bit more history about Paul Wenschel here as we kind of go through his life. After the primetime show was canceled, it was shifted to a children's show. And it aired off and on several networks until 1961. Also during that time, Paul Wenschel acted as himself, as a human, without the puppet. A lot in the early 60s, he did appearances on Dick Van Dyke and the Beverly Hillbillies. He was on Love American Style, shows like that. Eventually, though, he brought back the puppets and started a successful syndicated children's show called Wenschel Mahoney Time that ran for 3 years and 288 episodes. In the 70s, the owner of it, Metro Media, was planning on syndicating it again, and Paul Wenschel didn't like the terms, so he offered to buy them, and Metro Media gave him an ultimatum. Either agree to their terms or the tapes will be destroyed. He didn't. They did. They erased all of them. The lawsuits eventually went all the way to the Supreme Court and got Wenschel $18 million.
Whoa, man. Just every time we have like one of these lost media stories, it's just, it kills me. I mean, yeah, okay, the $18 million isn't bad, don't get me wrong. Right. But they lost all the shows?
They purposely erased them. Just to spite him because he wouldn't agree to their terms. So the biggest thing that you probably actually know Paul Wenschel from, and you've heard his voice many, many, many times, is his voice acting. He did a lot of voice acting work. In the 60s, he was Dick Dastardly on The Wacky Races, Get That Pigeon, Gargamel on The Smurfs, and most famously, he's the original voice of Tigger.
The wonderful thing about Tigger is Tiggers are wonderful things.
That was him, and that was kind of the hoo-hoo-hoo was an improv from him.
That's so charming. Well, that makes me feel better about him.
If you ever go back and watch some of his Knucklehead Smith, he has a very similar voice to him, actually. He also did a lot of commercial work. He was the scrubbing bubbles for many years. and so the voice that I can still picture this ad in my brain without whatever, he was the Tootsie Pop owl. One, two, crunch, three, Tootsie Roll owl. Yeah.
Oh, that's so weird. Oh my gosh. He's just been working in the background this whole time.
Yeah. So that segues pretty good into the children's version of the show, which we both watched, the one episode that's floating around on YouTube. What did you think of the children's show?
Okay, well, that one I actually liked that one a little bit, maybe a little bit better. There was kind of some cool things to look at, like there was like some Columbia pennants in the background because the guy was getting initiated and they were kind of doing this like frat house style thing, but it was a very light and not mean frat house.
Yeah, his frat house initiation mostly involved not getting hit in the face with pies.
Exactly. So yeah, and this is another good example. I think Well, the other one being more geared toward adults. This is the episode that when you close your eyes and think of a 1950s kids show, you've got the puppets, you've got the Americana, you've got the Boy Scouts, you've got the slapstick comedy, the, you know, screaming children audience. So, yeah, this had a little bit more to it. I mean, the Tootsie Roll advertising was the most obvious thing I've ever seen in my life. Yeah.
If anybody ever, if I ever hear a boomer or something complain about trash commercialism, especially with regards to children, I would just show them this, because there's literally, so the very first thing that they do is they pick some kids from the audience and they have them do a Tootsie Roll unrolling contest.
Right.
And then they have, they introduce the Tootsie Roll Man, who is a character on the show. And they mentioned Tootsie Roll probably, I don't know, 50 to 100 times, and I'm only slightly exaggerating. I mean, if you took a drink every time they said the word Tootsie Roll, you'd be unconscious 10 minutes in. It's really bad. I'm going to go ahead and play a clip here. It's actually got my favorite joke of both episodes in it, the Morse code bit.
Okay.
And you can see how it very subtly segues into a Tootsie Roll ad.
Oh, the Morse code transmitter, huh?
Yes, sir. Well, if you're so good at the Morse code, I'll give you a little message, and you see if you can take it down.
Yes, sir.
Okay, shoot. Here we go now. There.
I got it.
What does it say? No, silly.
No, I was only kidding. Why, that says, buy Tootsie Roll fudge.
That's exactly what it says. Buy Tootsie Roll fudge. You know, that's a good message for everybody. Because no kidding, boys and girls, Tootsie Roll fudge is the best tasting fudge you can buy anywhere.
So the funny thing is, you were talking about the initiation thing. That was an ad as well. He was one of the early adopters. So you could join the Jerry Mahoney Club by sending 50 cents or whatever. And they sold Jerry Mahoney and Knucklehead Smith dolls. And he had ventriloquism books and toys and merchandise and everything, which that also became illegal not too long into the 60s, because a lot of shows, like early shows like Romper Room and Howdy Doody, were basically advertisements for the toys.
Right, and that didn't come back again until the 80s and He-Man and all that nonsense, where when
at least by then it was actually illegal to advertise He-Man toys during He-Man. You could advertise it right beforehand and immediately afterwards.
Okay.
But you couldn't during it.
And within the last 5 minutes, I thought it was very brave to keep a lit flame near a wooden dummy.
I saw that too, and I was like, "What? No, don't do that."
Yeah, that was that. I definitely was like, that's a real fire there. this interesting little part where at the very end, where they have this, like I said, this college initiate type skit, Mahoney, was it the puppet or the man? I guess it was the puppet. The puppet makes the initiate promise to respect all children, even those of other races or religions, which I thought was a very interesting little addition, especially for a 50s TV show. It's just not something that you would tend to really hear, I don't think, at that point in time. And it kind of had a little, like, just kind of a nod of, like, a little undercurrent of, like, politics. Like, hey, kids, be cool. Don't hate people just based on, you know, race or religion alone. Like, be a good person.
There was a decent amount of that. But along with this, it all came in the 50s specifically. It all came from Jewish. Everything I've seen, like I saw a lot from Superman and things like that. It all came from Jewish people shortly after the Holocaust. For some reason, we're really big into not discriminating against race and religion.
I was wondering if those two things were related, because for people who don't know, my academic career is based a lot about within media, both pre, post, and during the Holocaust. And I thought that this was a very interesting post, like within 10 years or so after the Holocaust ended. You did see a rise in concern for inclusivity in, mm-hmm. especially I think in Jewish entertainment, and Jewish entertainers right. would put a stress on it. Yeah.
Right. Like Paul Winchell himself was, and as far as I can tell, a couple of the other people involved were not his sidekick, Milton DeLugge, though, who, by the way, he looked like he was having a blast doing it. I got to say, he really looked like he was having fun. He actually, Milton DeLugge, if you ever watched The Gong Show, viewers, he was the band leader on The Gong Show. He did a bunch of other things. He just died pretty recently.
Oh, well, that's too bad. No, he was cute. He was funny. I admit I chuckled when he like had the blindfold on and he was wandering through the plates.
Yeah.
For his initiation ceremony. Also, the part that I lost it at is at one point, because this is a live show, there's a kid crying really loudly in the background. And Mahoney, the puppet, ad-libs, "It's okay, you don't have to cry. They were initiated." And it was really cute. It was really cute.
Yeah, I tried to pull audio for that, but I couldn't make it work with the, you couldn't really hear the kid too well. But yeah, that was fantastic. You could also hear throughout that entire episode, sometimes the kids would get bored and start talking to each other in the background, because the entire audience is made up of under 10s. There was
grown-ups
in the whole thing. Yeah.
It was a madhouse. It was a complete zoo. I mean, I give a lot of respect to whoever has to wrangle these children into an audience. And then at the end of this episode, they like go up into the rafters and they're dancing around. And it's just like, it must have been pure chaos at like 300 decibels.
Oh, completely. Yeah. The kids, when they went crazy, they went absolutely nuts. This is where the Paul Winchell story gets interesting as we start to wrap things up here. So he was much more than an entertainer. In 1950, he was guest starring on a show called Arthur Murray's Dance Party, and he won a dance contest with Ricardo Montalban. He was introduced backstage to Dr. Henry Heimlich, and yes, that Dr. Henry Heimlich of the Heimlich Maneuver fame. The two developed a lifelong friendship, and so after watching a few surgeries, they worked together to invent a patent for the artificial heart.
Oh my God!
So, a few years later, they donated to the University of Utah, and Dr. Robert Jarvik used parts of Paul Winchell's artificial heart to actually make the artificial heart that he put into patients. And there's still some bits of that there going around, based large parts on Paul Winchell's designs.
Okay, that's really fascinating, because, I mean, I don't know the exact years, but my grandmother she had heart problems as a child, and she was actually one of the earliest recipients of an artificial heart. So
she has Paul Winchell to thank.
Oh my God, this is blowing my mind.
Yeah. So he actually invented a lot of devices in his life. He had 30 patents for products ranging from disposable razors all the way to a portable blood plasma defroster.
Oh my God.
His biggest project outside of the medical field was he developed a tilapia farming system that used non-potable water. It actually went all the way to a congressional hearing that they were going to try to solve third world hunger, but there were some flaws in it and it didn't quite work. But anyways, he got to it. While he was doing all of this and the acting and everything, he also got degrees in acupuncture and therapeutic hypnosis and practiced both of these. He was also a published author. He had 4 books. The first book, Ventriloquism for Fun and Profit, they actually mentioned it on the children's
version. They
mentioned
it on the show, and they gave it to the kids as a prize for the Tootsie Roll contest. Yeah.
So he also wrote 2 books about religion. In 1982, he wrote the book God 2000, Religion Without the Bible, in which he stated that religion had brought more chaos to humanity than any other invention of man. But in his second book, from 2004, titled Protect God, he stepped that back a bit and kind of still focused on theologic. I mean, it's way beyond me. Mm-hmm. I tried to skim a little bit of both books. They're both available online, and I don't understand it.
When did you say that the first one was published?
1982.
That's really interesting, because I remember from my shaky memory remembers that there was definitely a push that was the beginning of the push for fundamentalism, you know, in the United States. And I wonder if it was a pushback to sort of that rising, you know, that Reagan certainly ushered in, very hardcore fundamentalist Christian. There was a lot of books being published between 79 and, you know, 1990 that had to do with, you know, God, just Jesus saves, God is everything, right. Satan is here, satanic panic, blah, 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 blah. So that's really interesting. He definitely was kind of writing the zeitgeist on the opposite corner of that.
His intro to his second book, The Protect God in 2004, specifically mentioned at that point the then evangelical Christianity of George W. Bush, but also the Osama bin Laden 9/11 types. And he was kind of a pushback against extremism in any sort of way, at least from what I could understand. So in his final book, published shortly before his death in 2005, was an autobiography called Winch. I really wish I could find it, but it's going for $250 on Amazon right now.
Yikes.
In which he told about his abusive childhood and long-running battles with depression and other mental illness. And this is the armchair psychiatrist here. Probably bipolar, including his times being institutionalized, issues he had with his wife and the mother of his first wife and the mother of his children. By the way, one of whom, April Winchell, is the current voice of Clarabelle Cow for Disney, among other roles. So she's in the family business. A stranger in the family because of that book. He died in 2005. And that's the story of Paul Mitchell. Meanwhile, Jerry Mahoney and Knucklehead Smith currently reside in the Smithsonian Institute.
But they're not on display. They are only in the archives, so you can't see them.
I know. Howdy Doody is on display, and they are not. But I guess he's a little bit more famous.
Yeah, I think Howdy Doody kind of has a little bit of a more special place in my heart because my uncle and I have like a lot of like just like uncle and niece in jokes about Howdy Doody. So, you know, whatever. But I would still like to. I kind of want to see them. Now I'm kind of attached now that I know so much about Paul Winchell and his bizarre religious transformation and all these patents. I mean, just to even think that like this man is like the reason why my grandmother like survived.
Wow. Yeah.
That's wild. I did not know this. So I'm humbled.
So it's time to get our final grades. We use the normal A to F scale. A plus being the best, F or F minus, I suppose, being the worst. As always, Nos, your go first.
All right. Okay. Well, this one is a little harder for me to evaluate now that I know all this really fascinating information.
Don't let it influence you. The work is the work.
I know. Okay. So I honestly don't like the show very much. It's pretty boring. It's the type of nostalgia rendered with something like this in 2021. It's just not really geared toward people in my generation. So I don't get any of that happy fun time chemical. Yeah,
something that came out 30 years before you were born doesn't give you nostalgia.
Exactly. With that said, you know, I don't necessarily want to turn people off to it or say how awful it is. It's not awful, not by a long shot.
Right.
But, you know, I give, honestly, both of them a solid C.
Yeah.
Just a C.
See, I'm actually kind of the same way to not turn off. I, for whatever reason, cannot stand the format of those 50s kids shows. I love the variety segment. I laughed quite a bit during that. I'd give that one a B, maybe even a B plus, because I laughed and I wish I'd see more of it. Something about those 50s kids shows just turns my brain off. And I just don't like him. It's all personal preference. This was fine. It was just as good as episodes of Howdy Doody or something I've seen. Though not as good as, say, Kuklefran and Ollie, another contemporary show. I like that one more. But it also didn't have a kid audience. That might have something to do with it. I'd probably give that one like a C minus. I just don't like that format for whatever reason.
Yeah. I mean, there was some physical comedy where they had like a little moment where they were doing like a twister thing sort of like where they were like involved in a handshake or something. It was, you know, it was cute. It was cute. But yeah, I just don't really relate to it. So
yeah, me neither. All right. So it's time to fire up our UNIVAC, ENIAC, Computo, whatever we want to call it, giant supercomputer that the size of a small warehouse, punching all the cards, fire it up here. All right, it is picked for us. The strangely forgotten 90s Harry Anderson sitcom, Dave's World.
Oh! 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 I've seen Dave's World. I have not thought about Dave's World since the 90s. But
I honestly don't think anybody has.
I don't think anybody has. Well, my father's name is Dave. So it was always like, it's my dad, you know. I'm looking forward to this. Yay.
All right. So it's not streaming anywhere. It hasn't been rerun in 20, 30 years. But there are a handful of episodes on YouTube. We'll eventually have links to it in the episode description and on our social media, which Nas here is going to tell you all about. So until then, bye-bye.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of Random Access Television. And if you haven't already, please remember to subscribe to us on Apple and Spotify podcasts. We also love to read reviews, so go ahead and leave us one. You can find us at RATVPod, that's RATVPOD at twitter.com. And if you have questions, complaints, compliments, recipes, email us at RATVPod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Bye-bye.